This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Post Oak Savannah is an ecological region in Texas, a relatively narrow section of sandy soil prairie stretching from near Dallas south to Interstate 10. Early settlers described the savannah as a vast, endless sea of grasses and wildflowers, with sparsely scattered trees or motts of oaks on uplands. White-tailed deer, wild turkey, bison, black bear, squirrel, mountain lion, and red wolf were once common in the post-oak savanna. When cattle ranching came to Texas, Native American management of the savanna using prescribed burning and bison herds disappeared, and the savanna's oak understory has become overgrown and clogged, primarily with yaupon, scientifically known as Ilex vomitoria, a native shrub in the holly family that grows to a dense forest-choking thicket, and eastern red cedar, a dark evergreen sometimes referred to as a Texas Christmas tree. And it's not that these dense areas are unattractive. Far from it. They are deep and beautiful. But they are not open, golden, beckoning savanna. Almost 3 years ago, I purchased 100 acres of heavily wooded land in the post-oak savanna. And while there are a few spots on my land where glimpses of the legendary sea of grasses and oaks are possible, much work will be required to completely restore that lost landscape. Richard Louv, the author of Last Child in the Woods, a lauded book about the harmful effects of the disappearance of nature from our children's lives, spoke here a few weeks ago. He discussed a survey in which people of different nationalities were shown photos of different landscapes and were asked to identify their favorites. The landscape that was most universally appealing to the most people, the one photo that was most picked as a favorite, was a photo of a savanna, a grassland of intermittent trees. Louv speculates that humans maintain an evolutionary affinity for our original birthplace as a species, thought to be grassland savannas in Africa. The Texas savanna, along with other portions of the Great Plains, once represented the North American analog of those African homelands. Those of us who are trying to save what's left and bring back what's gone are therefore operating out of a deeply held, indeed a genetically programmed, human impulse for savanna and its bounty of grasses, meadows, shade trees, arable soil, and birds and wildlife. In short, a Garden of Eden, a paradise. A taste of autumn arrived this past week, and at my ranch, those areas where the savanna has been recently restored flashed their beauty, and it was indeed a paradise. Native tall grasses, especially little blue stem, waved golden and blood russet in the dry breezes, and the leaves on the post oaks towering above the grassland rustled and were beginning their annual turn to copper. Looking at the landscape, I saw an earlier era in Texas. One of my joys is to crank up the chainsaw and go into the forest to battle the yaupon and cedar in an attempt to gradually bring back post-oak savanna. And on Sunday, my little daughter and I went off deep down a trail to find a tree I'd been meaning to remove, a 20-foot-tall eastern red cedar grown upright between two taller post-oaks. I don't mind cedar at all. In some places, it makes a fine shade tree, but not right between two mature oaks on land to which you're trying to restore the savanna. I sat her on a log at a safe distance and approached the victim. Tree felling is not as straightforward as it seems. You don't just start on one side at the bottom and cut a straight line until the saw comes out the other. For one thing, the weight of the tree will soon pinch and trap your saw in the cut. For another, using that method, you wouldn't have any idea which direction the tree is going to fall, including the spot where you are standing. Instead, you first make a wide-open notch on the side of the tree to which you want the tree to fall. Next, you make a horizontal cut on the opposite backside from the notch, being careful not to cut all the way through and leaving a strip of fiber remaining as the hinge to guide the tree safely to the ground. Hopefully, the tree will begin to fall in the direction of the notch. At least that's the idea. And yet, on this particular cedar, after doing these textbook things, the tree leaned only a bit and then stopped. I looked up. Thick greenbrier vine had grown up along the oaks and now held the crown of the cedar in place, like a giant bug in a spider web. I gave the cedar a little shove in back, but it wouldn't go over. I looked at the notch in front and saw that it had closed down some, but could stand to be widened more. It's not exactly textbook, returning to make a second cut at the notch, but I decided to do it. I knelt down, I widened the notch, and then I sensed the tree closing slightly on the saw, and I had an immediate concern that the saw was becoming pinched. It was slightly stuck, and I gave a strong pull. In the blink of an eye, out the saw came, coming, coming, it wouldn't stop, and then suddenly I felt something contact my lower leg. I stopped moving. The saw stopped moving. Everything stopped moving. Silence. My mind said something like, is what just happened what I think just happened? And then it was time to look down. At the leg. My leg. There, 2 inches below the knee, a glistening red and white long and wide fleshy split in my body, dripping crimson trails onto my socks. It's bad. Not good at all. Can I stand? Yes. Can I walk? Yes. Can I talk? Sweetheart, I called to my daughter, whose happy universe had now become a major concern. We're going to leave now. We're going to go back and see Mama at the house. What happened, Dada? Nothing. We're just going to go back now. I moved quickly to her and swept her up in my left arm while carrying the chainsaw in my right. I certainly wasn't going to leave it there despite the emergency. After all, the thing cost $300, and what had happened wasn't its fault. Back at the house, I called out to my wife. I've had an accident. I need the first aid kit. Get the kids ready to go. We've got to go to a hospital. She looked at my leg and turned white. Decision time. Which hospital? Here in the country or an hour away back in Houston? I went to the bathroom and ran water over this ugly thing. Somehow, almost miraculously, the bleeding was already stopping. We had good bandages, antibiotic ointment, a big sterile trauma pad, plenty of gauze and medical tape. I wrap the dressings in place and we leave. I decide we're going back home to Houston. Hannah will drop me at the emergency room and take the kids home. On the way home, my daughter thankfully still seems mostly unaware of what has happened. We laugh a little, and she eats some bunny crackers and falls asleep. While Hannah drives 80, I call our friend Dr. K for help on getting help. Though she's on vacation in Florida, she listens to me describe the accident and the wound and advises me to go to the hospital where she treats patients and which is near our house. She says she'll call ahead and have them get ready. When we arrive an hour later, they're ready, but not as ready as I would like. I sit outside the emergency room area and fill out all my paperwork and information for the admitting clerk. He says it'll be about 20 minutes as another patient has just arrived by ambulance. I limp over to the waiting area and watch the New England Patriots play some football against the Dallas Cowboys. Someone is lying in the middle of the field with a hurt leg, and the trainers are attending to him. I'm finally admitted. The nurse takes my vital signs and tells me Dr. B, the emergency room attending physician, will be in shortly. I ask how many chainsaw accidents they get in here. He can't think of any. It's mostly heart attacks and ongoing ailments. Dr. B arrives and cuts off my bandages. He frowns. It's okay, I tell him. I'm not having any trouble walking, so there's no broken bone. I think it just needs to be sewn up. Dr. B looks at me and begins to discuss the potential for infection from the saw. We'll need antibiotics, a tetanus shot, some x-rays to make sure the bone wasn't hit, a cleaning kit, and we may have to call in Dr. M, the head of surgery, who is at home. Now I'm frowning. All of this activity for my careless and unsafe operation of a chainsaw. Dr. B first squirts the wound with a steady jet of cold peroxide. Then he takes a syringe and begins to inject local anesthetic all around the wound. Up to now, the pain has been manageable, even minor. But now I find myself growling, gritting my teeth, breathing deep, forcefully squeezing the assistant's hand as Dr. B jabs that thing all around, injecting. Pretty quickly, though, it's totally numb down there, and I feel terrific, like I'm ready to hop off the table and run home. Now he's cleaning the wound with rubber-gloved hands, removing dried blood, loose tissue, patches of who knows what. With all of this miasma and gore gone, the extent of the wound becomes clear. It looks, really, like a big shark bite. Dr. B decides it's necessary, after all, to call Dr. M for a phone consultation while I'm carted off to on the gurney for x-rays. Back in the room, the x-rays are thrown up on the light board. Dr. B moves in close for a look. There's a little nick on the front of the shin bone. Not much at all, but there it is. Is that good? A little nick? Is that bad? A little nick. I don't know, and Dr. B has left the room. The nurse comes in and puts a tetanus shot in my arm. Ouch! And then a massive syringe of antibiotic in my butt. Oh my God, does that hurt! Now we wait for Dr. M, the head of surgery. It's about 5 p.m. on Sunday. The Patriots are playing the Cowboys, and I've chainsawed my own leg. I fall asleep and am awakened by the sound of Dr. M's entry. Handsome, in his mid-40s, dressed in jeans, a sport shirt, 5 o'clock shadow and casual loafers with no socks, his lab coat on, Dr. M looks at the x-ray first, and then removes the gauze now covering the wound. He begins issuing orders for supplies immediately, suture kit, bandages. I start talking about how careless I feel, but how quickly it happened. He says I'm lucky that the saw didn't go farther into the bone, no kidding, or it would have been a different story. He's going to sew it up, but we have to watch for infection also. He checks to see if Dr. B's local anesthetic is still going strong, poking around the wound. Do I feel that? That? How about that? No, nothing. I feel nothing. Dr. M begins to sew plastic sutures into my skin using some kind of J-shaped fish hook. As he weaves, we talk. I apologize for dragging him out on a Sunday. He says no big deal, the only thing he's missing is the Patriots-Cowboys game. He says the minute they told him it's a chainsaw accident, he figured he'd better come in. He describes his own recent mishap, falling from a balcony that resulted in 2 broken heels, a compressed vertebra, and a fractured hand. I guess that makes me feel better. It can happen to anyone, even the head of surgery. I watch as he works, that gaping trench in my leg gradually being pulled closed by his hand stitching. Truly, Dr. M's work is fantastic. Obviously the result of long practice and extraordinary skill. As he finishes, I move in close to look. It's closed, and it looks about as good as such a thing can possibly look. Certainly a dramatic improvement from the gaping wound of only a few moments before. He prescribes some pills and wants to see me on Thursday, this afternoon, after my radio show. On that same day, today, the Congress of the United States will take a vote to override President Bush's veto of the recent upgrade of the state Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as SCHIP. This program is designed to provide health insurance for children whose parents earn too much money for them to receive Medicaid, but too little to be able to afford private health insurance. And Democrats are trying to increase the income limits to admit more children into the program, since more children than ever before are now uninsured in our country. The money that is under consideration is in the tens of billions of dollars. While this is a lot of money, it is a small fraction of what the President and the Congress have authorized for the appalling and disastrous war in Iraq. Still, the President argues that it's too much money, and that the proposed modifications to this successful program will further push the United States towards fiscal irresponsibility and socialized medicine, which he regards as some kind of evil. As a taxpayer, however, I have decided that I want my money to stop going to the war in Iraq and all of the other nonsense that George Bush sees value in, and to instead go to children whose parents are unable to afford health insurance for them. One of the things that makes Savannah unique is that it sponsors so many different types of wildlife: insects, mammals, grasses and trees, amphibians, birds of all stripes, humans. Savannah makes room and provides care, livelihood, and shelter to all, young and old, large and small, alike. So it should be with our healthcare system, a broad, verdant Savannah that provides care for all, including the most helpless among us. And if the President doesn't agree, perhaps he can be persuaded with a chainsaw to his leg, combined with an ominous, silent refusal to treat his wound by the extraordinarily talented and dedicated doctors of our nation. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host. Truly, for sure, a pleasure to be to be with you in one piece this morning here on October 18th. www.newcapitalshow.com is our address on the web. Welcome to all of those who join us via podcast on Apple iTunes and other podcast directories. And welcome, of course, to everyone in the Houston listening area, those of you who listen to 90.1 KPFT, and there are more and more of you every day. Welcome. We'll be taking your calls a bit later in the show, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT is the number. It is my pleasure to announce that we will be having our first New Capital event. Movie night. It's going to be movie night. Our very talented and dedicated Teb Loki has been working on this, and here's what it says. Join me, Leo Gold, and the staff of the New Capital Show for an evening of entertainment and discussion at the Artery, arteryhouston.org, a unique art venue in the Museum District. On Thursday, November 1st, New Capital Show will sponsor a free showing of the 1990 documentary Berkeley in the 60s. This highly entertaining film features archival footage of the free speech and anti-war movements in Berkeley during the 1960s, interviews with leaders of the student movements, and the great music from the period. The gates to the Artery will open at 6:30 p.m., and the movie will start promptly at 7. Following the film, I will moderate an informal discussion about lessons of the documentary that may be relevant to people involved in social movements today or just any of you out there. The evening should conclude by 10 o'clock. Artery is located on the wooded lot at the corner of Jackson and Prospect, about one block east and two blocks north of the Children's Museum in the Museum District in Houston. We'll have an outdoor viewing screen. There are many fascinating light sculptures and other attractions on the grounds of the Artery. There will be light snacks and soft drinks and wine and beer available for a modest donation. Seating is on cinder block benches, folks. So if you have a tender tush, you might want to bring a pillow or a stadium seat. Parking is on the streets around the Artery, so carpool if possible, and we'll be putting more of this up on our website, www.newcapitalshow. It'd be a great chance to meet and greet all of you. Seating is limited to 80 people, so that's the deal. You walk in at 7, you may not get a seat. That'll be, again, on November 1st, the first New Capital Show event. And if you want to sign up so you get newsletters for these events, you can do that at www.newcapitalshow.com, and that'll give you a jump on these things. Just a couple of news items, and we're going to get to your calls. Again, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Yes, I disagree with the president on his position on expanding this children's health insurance program. I'm very pleased that the president held his ground on honoring the Dalai Lama. I think it was truly a great moment. Absolutely hysterical calls from from communist Chinese government and the communist Chinese government in Tibet calling the award a farce and all sorts of other things. This is truly what we consider to be projecting. Truly what we consider to be projecting. Dalai Lama, of course, one of the great humans of peace and understanding and compassion in this world. And his comment yesterday was he was sorry for the commotion and difficulty that it has caused. If we were all lamas like the Dalai Lama, the world would have much fewer problems. I want to congratulate the president for going through with his honoring of the Dalai Lama. I am a harsh critic of his, but when he does something right, there it is. A little more news. Call for cap on CO2 credit price. This is from our friend John Fialka at the Wall Street Journal, October 17th. Executives of major utilities are prodding Congress to install a feature in climate change legislation that would prevent the price levied upon carbon dioxide emissions from rising too high. You got that? Let me read you that sentence again. You know, I want to make sure that you get that. Executives of major utilities are prodding Congress to install a feature in climate change legislation that would prevent the price levied upon the carbon dioxide emissions of their power plants from rising too high. Right, and of course, we know that these are free market, open market executives, right? We want free markets. We want deregulated power prices. Except, of course, when it comes to the price of carbon emissions. Now we're lobbying Congress to install a feature that would prevent the price from rising too high. We call that a cap. Our free market friend executives in the utility industry, who run utility companies that want deregulation, that is, they want to set the price free of electricity in places where they serve customers, they want a cap on carbon emission prices. At least 26 utilities have signed a letter calling for an, quote, economic safety valve as part of a system that would set a limit on such emissions and require companies to use government-issued credits for each ton of CO2 they emit. Says John Bryson, president and chief executive officer of Los Angeles-based Edison International, we need a mechanism that would send a more predictable price signal that would help us plan for the billions of dollars of investments that we and others will have to make to move to a desired lower carbon economy. No, you don't. High prices will tell you exactly what you need to know about the investments you need to make. And if you're concerned right now about uncertainty, then you should do, sir, Mr. Bryson, what all of us investors do when faced with uncertainty. We diversify. We don't put all our eggs in one basket. We hold some domestic stocks, some foreign stocks, some domestic bonds, some foreign bonds, some commodities. And you can do the same thing, sir. You don't have to put only coal-fired power plants up. You don't have to put only dirty sources of energy up. Right now, as we speak, you could be building solar plants. Maybe you are. You could be building wind plants. You could be engaging in conservation programs with your consumers. No. You want the federal government to put a cap on something that hasn't even come into place in this country yet, which is a tax on carbon. Mr. Bryson and other utility chiefs plan to send a letter today to Senator Barbara Boxer, chairman of the Senate Environment Committee, calling the measure critically important. Right? Our free market business executives want a price cap. Said James Rogers, chairman and CEO of Duke, which actually has been out front of this issue. He says, in my mind, it comes down to consumers versus commodity traders. And my friends, we see this all the time. It's called hypocrisy. It's called hypocrisy and inconsistency. People who get out in front of you and tell you that free, unfettered, open markets where there are market clearing mechanisms for everything. That's what we got to have, right? And by the way, everything has got to be outsourced. There can't be any government running of operations. Our military's got to be outsourced to Blackwater, and, you know, we can't have any government involvement in medical care and health care. Suddenly, when it comes to their own issues and their own livelihoods, these guys are calling for price controls. What could be more un-free market, un-Republican business-like than price controls? These emperors have no clothes. They know it. They don't care. It's worth it for them to do it. What? You know, they get an article in the Wall Street Journal. You need to call them on it. You're the power. 713-526-5738. One more piece, and then we're going to get to Susan first. October 16th, New York Times. A green resort is planned to preserve ruins and coastal waters. I'm not going to tell you where this is. This is great. I'm not going to tell you where this is taking place. I'm just going to tell you what it is, and then I'll tell you where it is. In this remote eastern region of blank, where the bleak hills resemble a lunar landscape, the Green Mountain Sustainable Development Area is the latest in a spate of recently announced projects that form a sort of environmental coming out party for this former pariah country. Fleets of white Mercedes vans ferried guests along newly paved roads for a dinner among the ruins and a signing ceremony presided over by X, eldest son of Y. In an area where many residents are illiterate, newly erected signs in crisp white and blue say airport in Arabic and English. Development is coming to town. In an area the size of Wales, centered on the Greek ruin here, the younger X, a group of wealthy compatriots, and a bevy of consultants are planning a carbon neutral green development zone, catering to tourism and serving as a model for environmentally friendly design, they say. The plan will protect the fantastic ruins from haphazard development as it protects the coastal ecosystem, one of the last remaining natural areas. The idea is that as this country opens to the outside world, it will not become like a more developed coast, said the project's financial advisor. The intention is clearly broader than that. They want to show the world that this country has turned a corner and can fit into the modern world, says the leader of the project. In our area, it's not common practice to talk about environment and emissions and the like, but it is now time to join in this effort. So we make this statement about the environment, about culture. We are civilized, he said. You tell me, what country is this? What country is this where the leaders are turning to sustainable environmental development? 713-526-5738. Okay, first up, let's take Susan. Welcome, Susan.
Well, Leo, I certainly hope you're going to be okay.
I'm good. I'm on the mend.
I want to say you have an extraordinary talent for narrative. You had me nearly crying.
No. In pain, wincing in pain, huh?
You're ideally suited to the radio, and I can see why you've gotten kudos. It's,
thank you.
You had me hanging.
Yeah, I had my leg hanging.
you're spot on about everybody having such, you know, good health care available to them, and it's too bad that our resources are being spent on destroying things and people rather than trying to make them healthy.
Yeah, I mean, you want to get religion real quick on the need for people to have a secure way to obtain health care, you know, chainsaw your leg.
Exactly. I want to say, if you've entered into that group of people who have to maintain themselves in a sort of at least close to sterile bubble while you heal.
Yeah, I've been doing that, Susan. I've had the products are excellent. I've had good antibiotic pills and ointment and sterile pads. And you're right. You have to do that for all of you out there. If you get a bad accident with a tool, you know, and you think you've hit something, almost more important than, you know, the bleeding and the bones and all that is the sterility. And so I just want to tell everybody that the chance of infection goes up very high.
I wonder if while you were out in rural areas, you missed the kind of nightly lead news story everywhere about these staph infections that are not only breeding in hospitals, but now, you know, this whole school down in Virginia is being shut down with people going in and swabbing everything with sterile bleach and all of that kind of stuff. It's really a little scary how antibiotics are great when you need them, but they're sort of turning on us by overuse to some extent, and this thing is now getting out into everyday life.
Yep, you're right. Susan, thanks for the call. Pleasure to hear from you. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, taking your calls today. We can talk about, you know, what's on your mind? A lot going on. The Dalai Lama gets an award, and it's kind of a signature moment. as the world has become a huge and massive customer of China. China has become a major creditor of our country. And yet here we want to honor someone who is seeking religious freedom and some autonomy for the Tibetan homeland, and they go berserk. And you start to see that people labor under enormous amounts of delusion. Enormous amounts of delusion. Let's see, our friend Johnny. Hey, Johnny.
Hey, Leo. I'm glad to hear you're doing better.
Yep, I'm good.
Surprised that you did that to yourself.
Me too.
But then again, I know lots of doctors, they do goofy things, so you're in good company.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, your narrative was pretty good, I have to agree, and it got me to thinking, you know, there's an important point to be made from what I thought about your narrative, and that's how easily the right criticizes the left for being so anti-people, and they were so for the environment that we care about the snail daughter. But then when we turn around and we do
right.
approve that we're not just about that, we're all-inclusive, then they turn around and they shoot backwards. I mean, they shoot themselves in the
foot. Well, Johnny,
I.e. last night on Bill Maher, called Bill Maher last night, and Carlton Tucker, whatever the hell his name is, he's an NBC commentator,
mm-hmm.
that bow-tie-wearing jerk. God, he just irritates the crap.
Now. Be a llama, Johnny.
I'm trying, but it's hard. And there's one other thing, too. You know, the right often claims the reason they dominate the airwaves while we occupy a tiny amount of the spectrum is because our message or our messages don't have the relevance or aren't what people, the majority of the people, want to hear, that it doesn't resonate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sparsely provide any kind of spectrum space for people on the left. They do for brief periods, for an hour or two at night, and then they cancel them all of a sudden, and then they put back more of the same right-leaning, extremist, vitriolic crap. And then, you know, it hit me. The same way our society has to go out of the way to get normally peaceful people, you know, through Hollywood and Madison Avenue and Nashville and the schools, take them from the formative years in childhood on up to the teenage years and young adulthood, that all we have to go out of the way to conspire to get peaceful people to get militaristic, to get on the militaristic bandwagon and kill people far away from home in these clothes that they don't normally wear, the same way that our society does that. And now I forgot my point. I have to see another senior moment.
Johnny, thanks.
Oh, my God.
It's great to have you. Thanks, Johnny.
I'll call back if I remember.
Okay, very good. Well, look, there are inconsistencies riven through the narratives that and the major narratives that exist in our society. You know, each of us has our own inconsistent narratives. I've got plenty. I'm sure that if you were to undertake an analysis of New Capital shows, you would find plenty of inconsistencies. But it's important to strive to eliminate inconsistencies, because it forces rigorous thinking. It forces you to refine what it is that you believe in. And I think that too often we see in many politicians and many political arguments a lack of a good faith attempt to close down inconsistencies. And I've seen that a lot, and I see that a lot in what I would call the conservative Republican approach to things in the past couple of decades, where arguing on behalf of an idea in one area and arguing on behalf of it in such a way that it should be monolithic, that it's a one-size-fits-all solution, whether that be government out of everything and free markets for everything, suddenly is not advice that they want to take when it regards their own pocketbooks. And listen, there are going to be liberals where that problem exists. We're all guilty of that. But we need to make a good faith effort. It's my perception that progressives are in the forefront of making that effort right now. And I'm proud to be a part of that movement. But it's going to take all of us. It's going to take conservatives, liberals, progressives. It's going to take all of us having honest arguments and consistent arguments. Consistency is crucial and vital. This is the New Capital Show here on 90.1 KPFT, Houston, Texas FM, part of the Pacifica Radio Network, and www.newcapitalshow.com. Welcome to all listeners locally and, frankly, now across the world. I get emails from Japan, Rochester, New York. Welcome to all of you. Our next call is going to be, and by the way, Larry, caller Larry, says that the article that I was referring to about this sustainable development going on in this former pariah nation, it's Libya. Remember? The dictator Gaddafi? The dictator Gaddafi, his son, is now involved in sustainable ecological development. And I've never been to Libya, but I can only imagine that there are places there that are stunningly beautiful along the Mediterranean coast, Greek and Roman ruins. And the son of Gaddafi, the oldest son, is dedicating himself to sustainable development and preserving these areas. The dictator. So if their dictator can do these things, hopefully our dictator can do these things too. Okay. Yeah. Next up is Jeff. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you. Leo, I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
And faithful listener. I just wanted to tell you briefly that I really like your no-nonsense, simplistic approach to things with respect to the price controls and how if we simply let the system equalize things out, the truth will come to the surface. So I appreciate that. And in that vein, I am a student of environmental science, but I work in the car business, strangely enough. And I was reading about Ford's carbon neutral production of the hybrid Escape, and I wondered if you were what you thought of that, and I feel like that is another one of those controlled promotional aspects of business, or whether it really means something.
Jeff, I'm not familiar with it. Are you saying that that not only is Ford producing a hybrid, but the processes that they're using, they're attempting to offset the carbon emissions that result from the process of manufacture?
Exactly.
Well, I applaud that, and if they get some PR out of it, great. I got no problem with that.
My question is, do you know? I wonder how that is that a legitimate claim? Is it who guides the ability of people to say that, and is there kind of a regulating overall body that says this is what you have to do to be carbon neutral?
Yeah. Okay, Jeff. Thanks. I don't know. We don't have a lot of authorities for these things right now. They're getting worked out, and people are coming to this every day. We have a tidal wave. We have a tsunami of interest in environmental issues, specifically as it relates to climate change. As most of us know, Albert Gore was just awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work, and he was awarded along with the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, which is a vitally important panel which tries to reach consensus, and a panel which itself has come out and said this is for real. And you have to imagine, as many of my guests who've come on before to talk about the IPCC have said, that this is a multinational panel, and for the release, for the decision and the opinions to be issued by the IPCC, they have to be basically unanimous. So you can imagine that what results is a watered-down version of some of the stronger opinions that are being voiced. So these are the winners of the Nobel Prize. Jeff brings up an excellent point that, frankly, I just think we need to focus on, which is that not only do our products that emerge from our manufacturing processes need to be environmentally sensitive, but the processes involved in making them themselves need to be such. And I think that there are many companies now that are becoming aware of this and dedicating themselves to it. I truly believe it. We have some fantastic engineering talent in all industries in this country. I am so delighted to see younger generations coming into our corporations, into our businesses, into our factories. I'm delighted to see some of our most powerful and influential consulting firms, the McKinseys of the world, beginning to develop practices in this area, because they know that what makes environmental sense makes business sense. And it's fantastic. And fighting against environmental sensibility is a losing battle. It's a losing battle. And it's not a well-thought-out approach. So, Jeff, I don't know about Ford's particular issue and their particular program, but I applaud it, and I think that not only do the products need to be environmentally sensitive, but the the manufacturing process needs to be such as well. And of course, what we're seeing in China is a complete lack of that. In China, we're now seeing products that themselves may not be environmentally safe, but we certainly know that the processes that are being used in China are utterly unenvironmental, and it's destroying that country in many ways. It's sad to see. Let's take Matthew. Matthew, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hello, Leo. You've got the top show, one of the best shows in the U.S.
Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah,
I appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Listen, I just wanted to have a recommendation. A pole chainsaw. Chainsaws with extension poles. Have you heard of those?
I've seen those, but my gosh, Matthew, I'm afraid it'll be my head if I use one of those.
Well, actually, you're so far away from it, at least 8 feet, that... You know, you're far less likely for something to happen.
Now, that's for reaching up into the upper branches of the tree, right?
Well, it depends. No, you can use it for cutting down a small tree. I wouldn't cut down a big tree, but, you know, you can use it for all types of things. It's not so much for using to cut up high.
Yeah.
You use it to cut a bush flush with the ground.
I'll check it out, Matthew.
Stay away from the blades.
Yeah.
Thank you, Leo.
Yeah, thanks, Matthew. For those of you in interested in chainsawing, I can't imagine there are that many of you, but they're... I've discovered that there is something called a chainsaw chaps, pants, that are made out of like Kevlar. And if the chain should come in contact, it'll jam the chain. So I've got those on order. Matthew, thank you for the suggestion. Let's take Greg. Greg, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I have a question that's kind of off of topic. But since you're a financial advisor, it's on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious about your opinion about the bailout for banking companies. I've been in Houston since the mid-'80s and lived through the collapse of the real estate market in the mid-'80s here in Houston. And, you know, well remember the long lists on the RTC pages for bids and how awful that was. My question is, can you give me any insight? It seems like the media is staying away from this topic largely, and I'm just wondering how free market administration can sponsor bailouts like this, propping up the banking industry, and is this something that should concern all of us who have money in banks or money in stocks?
What are your thoughts?
What are my thoughts?
Yeah.
I'm just... You know, I tend to be very left of things, and, you know, in talking to friends, I am not too optimistic about the stability of the U.S. economy, and I think it's a much bigger player in the global economy than maybe some people want to give it credit for, and I'm just very concerned and worried. You know, it's I saw what happened when... whole subdivisions were empty in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not so concerned that this will happen again. I'm just wondering, you know, if there is some sort of dark period ahead, what do you have as an insider or as somebody who, you know, is probably much more informed than I am on this?
Okay, Greg, thanks for the call. We're going to hang up and I'll give some comments.
Okay.
What Greg is referring to is an issue called moral hazard. And moral hazard occurs when incentives are created for people to behave in bad or irrational ways. In economics, the term moral hazard is often used to describe the making whole of investors who have made bad investments. And so that's what Greg is asking about, this talk recently from the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and others pushing for aid to financial institutions that may have taken on bad housing loans, bad subprime mortgages. Now, you know, there are a couple of issues. Who is this being done for? What is the need for keeping banks solvent? Well, of course, if you have your money in a bank and you're just an average rank and file depositor, you know, then I would argue that there should be mechanisms in place to protect your deposits. I mean, why should you as a depositor be held responsible because executives of a bank ran it poorly and made poor investments. You were there simply to deposit your money and to have it be kept safely. And in fact, since the Great Depression, you may or may not know that the United States prior to the Great Depression, in the century before it, endured many panicky runs on banks. And so the banking system that we have now, I think, is far more stable than what it was in its early days, and hopefully things improve. Now, shareholders in banks, maybe we're talking about something different. As a shareholder, you're making an investment to hold the common stock in the bank. You're making an implicit bet. You're making an implicit vote in the management of the bank, and that the management of the bank is going to take deposits in and is going to use those deposits in ways that are not only profitable but also fiscally sound. And so I think that whatever is done as regards banks, the government always needs to distinguish between depositors and shareholders. Now, moral hazard is created whenever government moves to bail out shareholders, because the shareholders get the idea, I don't have to monitor investments, I don't have to make good investments, I don't have to hold management accountable, because the government will step in and make my losses whole whenever things go south. So I am not in favor, in most cases. I mean, there may be cases where there are exceptions, but I am not in favor, as a general rule, of, you know, bailing out shareholders. At the same time, we also have to recognize that many of us, if not all of us, are now shareholders in worldwide businesses. If you have 401k plans or pension plans, or you're part of the teacher's pension plan, they hold shareholding in corporations. So it's not so simple. It's not so cut and dried. In general, I'm not in favor of bailing out and thereby creating moral hazard. On the other hand, I think that, you know, we have to recognize that we can all be hurt. Those of us who unintentionally had no clue that we're invested in Citibank, you know, but you hold a fund that has shareholding in Citibank. You're a shareholder in Citibank. So there's no easy answer, and I think that's probably the way the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department approaches these things. We've got to look at it and see who is it that's getting hurt. If it's rank and file people who are not savvy investors, you know, I would say that we need to protect those people. If it's savvy investors, people with a lot of money, hedge fund investors, wealthy people who generally have skill, I would say those people shouldn't be bailed out. Let's take Lorena, line 3. Welcome, Lorena.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to talk about the sustainability of public transportation, because I know that we live in Houston, and there's really no public transportation. They might say there is, but the reality is there isn't.
Why do you say there's no? Tell me your experience.
What?
Tell me your experience. Why do you say there's
Well, I mean, the light rail, for example, which I think is a good example of, like, public transportation, it's, you know, minimal pollution, a lot of people get on it, it's clean and it's effective. But if you look at the bus routes, the buses that we have aren't very sustainable. And I'm talking about more like above ground trains, more light rail like trains. Mm-hmm. Because you have big commuters coming in from, you know, the outlying suburbs, and they're all, you know, polluting with their cars. Mm-hmm. Not very many people have hybrids. And I mean, what do you think the viability is of public transportation? Is Michael, especially in a city like Houston.
Is it Lorena or Lorena?
It goes either way.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll go toward Lorena. Lorena, what do you think public transportation is feasible in Houston or can be improved in Houston?
I don't know, my big question is, I think that as Houston, we all have a car mentality, especially in Texas. I mean, commercials are made for us.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, because, I mean, there is a movement. Would it be as a city if we all kind of got together and said that perhaps cars are selfish and we should try to move to something more green?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if that's even economically viable, or how to get people to do that. And I guess I'll get off the air and try to let you answer that.
Okay, Lorena. Well, I wanted to hear your thoughts, because, you know, I feel like I've made my thoughts pretty clear on the show before, that of course we need to do a better job of creating public transportation, and we need to be creative in how we implement it. In Houston, Houston is a city that is different than cities when public transportation first came about in the 19th century and, you know, in the early 1900s. Cities were smaller then, urban centers were more concentrated, and so subways went in, and cable car systems went in, and electric trolley car systems went in, and those were the answer then. We have to be creative and recognize that the city that we live in now looks very different than those cities. And the answer is, yes, we need to do a better job of public transportation. We need to do a better job on all of these things. I think that there are many people in the city here and other cities like Houston, Los Angeles, and you know, metro sprawls that are committed to thinking deeply about how to do this. And this isn't just a liberal issue. There are conservatives with important voices to be heard, and who often bring voices of sanity to and reason to the discussion of public transportation. So we need everybody involved. The answer is yes. We must do a better job. And it's not just public transportation. That goes hand in hand with urban planning. Where do we live and work? How are our lives planned? Where are our retail places? We need to do a better job of doing all of those things. So the answer, in my opinion, Lorena, is yes. We have any more time, Kevin? Or are we out? Two more minutes. Johnny's called back. Johnny, you got 30 seconds.
I got it. Listen, I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. We're not the only ones who feel so insecure about our position, the obvious truths that we bring to light all the time. We're not the ones who feel it necessary to conspire behind closed doors and buy up all the radio and TV space.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that are doing it because they know they have the false position. So that's what we need to remind ourselves and not be on the defensive. They're the ones that do a good job of seeming like we're the ones who don't know what's going on, that we're out of touch, when in reality, they're the ones
Johnny,
who are
thanks.
Out of touch.
Johnny, thank
good
you.
Good job, Leo. You answered her question,
thank
by
you.
The way.
And I want to thank Annie, who has sent me an email here. My husband is a forester, and the number one rule of using a chainsaw is wearing the appropriate gear. Never, all caps, use a chainsaw without wearing chain-proof chaps. They're not too expensive, and she sent me a link. So, Annie, thank you very much. Yes, I'm not going to pick up the saw again until I've got those. I want to thank all of you for tuning in today and for taking time to be a part of the New Capital Show, www.newcapitalshow.com. Back with you next week. Up next, George Ryder and John McNamara with Thresholds. Thanks to Kevin Wilcutz and Laura Slavin for engineering the show. Take care.
Pioneers 2007 conference. Join us in exploring practical solutions at the crossroads of ecological restoration, human health, social service, and the sacred. October 19th through the 21st at Emerson Unitarian Church on Bering Drive between Westheimer and San Felipe. Details at texasbioneers.org. Restoring our ecosystems, preserving cultures, greening economies, building community. The annual Bioneers Conference connects the dots among diverse ideas, peoples, and movements to inspire a life-affirming culture of healing and justice. Explore, connect, and celebrate. October 19th through the 21st. Full details found at texasbioneers.org or by calling 713-768-3422. This is Pacifica Radio 90.1 KPFT Houston.
KPFT KPFT brings back the fall concert series at the Miller Outdoor Theater starting this Sunday, October 14th, and will continue every Sunday afternoon through November 18th from 4 to 7. Admission is free.
Come out and meet your favorite KPFT radio personalities and experience the diverse sounds from your community radio station.
Again, the fall concert series began.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.